the conference facility. If you go on to DECRA.com, on the front page there's a button that will take you to the presentation that we have in front of us now. To start off with, I'd like to say it's been a very momentous year for DECRA. The business has been completely transformed. The integration of Eurovet has gone extremely well, and with that critical mass we felt in a comfortable position to become a pure pharma business by the disposal of our services segment. So, you know, we already had a strategic focus that was entirely orientated around our veterinary pharmaceuticals business, and now that focus is very clear indeed, and we'll cover an awful lot about that throughout the presentation. Looking at page 3 of the presentation, just a little bit to add on Eurovet. We covered this in detail at the half year results, so I don't intend to repeat all the key points on this page. However, I think it's important to remind people that we have delivered the synergies that we expected, that were outlined in the prospectus for the fundraising to acquire this business, and there are further synergies to come, predominantly of a revenue nature, because we still have a number of the Eurovet products that are marketed for us by third-party companies where we've now served time on those distribution agreements, and they will come back in-house from 2014 onwards. So there's more revenue synergies to come out of this business. In terms of the divestment of MVS, this has been part of our strategic plan for a number of years, and I said at the outset, you know, we have the critical mass now that we stand alone as a veterinary pharmaceutical business. The services business, particularly MVS, was coming under increasing revenue pressure, and it was harder to compete on a UK-centric basis. The customer base is consolidating. That was creating a bigger demand on cash flows. Customers expected longer payment terms and also higher discounts allowed. And I think if you look at the graph on that page, the blue section being the contribution of MVS to group profit, you can clearly see that MVS was becoming less and less significant to us from a profit contribution perspective. And of course, you know, the sale does create a very strong balance sheet, which, you know, gives us flexibility to invest in future opportunities should they arise. Just before I pass you on to Anne to look at the numbers in detail, the graphs on page 5 are just a basic outline of the global animal health market. As you can see, North America and Europe, where our current trading subsidiaries are based, account for 65% of the global market. However, if you look at the bar chart on the right, you can see that the big growth areas within animal health from the Asia Pacific region and the rest of the world. And this is really due to developing countries having a higher demand for high quality meat, and of course high quality meat needs an increased amount of pharmaceutical usage. What's also really interesting is if you look that our performance against these numbers, where we've got a global growth of 2.2%, but the vast majority of our sales are in Europe, and Europe has seen a decline of 4% over the period. So I think that really does help to frame the perspective of which you view our numbers as Anne now presents them.
Thank you, Ian. Good morning, everyone. Before I dive into some of the financial highlights on page 6, I want to clarify two things. As you may recall, we acquired Eurovet in May 2012, so the 2012 number that you'll see and that were reported only has 5 weeks of revenue and profit. So bear that in mind in terms of comparison between 2013 and 2012. The other thing is that as we completed the divestment of services, from an accounting perspective, it is accounted for as a discontinued operation. And but on this page, we have shown continued and discontinued operations for ease of reference, and that's how we will go through this presentation, so it's easier to follow the flow. Now, moving to the numbers, our pharmaceutical revenue at £189 million has grown by 56.6% in constant currency, and all of our territories performed very well. I'll come back later on the gross profit percentage and the movements on that. I'll cover that. Further down, going down the P&L, you can see that our underlying operating profit and our underlying profit before tax is actually growing slightly faster than sales. and that is a very strong performance with the pharmaceutical business underlying operating profit at £39.1 million. Now finally on this page I also want to highlight the EPS. As a result of our performance, the total combined EPS is 38.71 pence per share. And for the continuing operation, it's 29.07 pence, which is a 42% increase versus last year. So if I start going down the numbers, picking up on the components of the growth for revenue, I mentioned earlier Eurovet. So Eurovet had contributed incremental sales of £62.8 million. We have previously reported supply issues in the US, and in particular in 2013, the disruption on Animax created loss of sales of £1.3 million. If I strip out those two factors, we can see that our organic growth, incremental sales, was £8.9 million, which is a growth of 7.2% versus last year. Now, if you put this in the context of the animal health market growth that Ian was outlining earlier at 2.2%, it is a very strong performance, and we've performed very well in the market. Following the acquisition of Eurovet, we organized our sales and marketing team around three categories: companion animal products, food producing animal products, and diet. Companion animal products, so what you see here on this slide are sales at reported currency and growth rates at constant exchange rate. Companion animal grew at 8%. And we have seen growth in all our most of our therapeutic areas, in particular endocrinology, dermatology, and ophthalmology. And our key products on which we often report have performed very well. So for instance, Vetoryl, which is a product for Cushing disease in dog, has grown by 18% on a global basis. Felimazole, which is for feline hypoparathyroidism, has grown by 28%. And with the Eurovet acquisition, we also started competing in a new category or therapeutic area for us, cardiovascular, with a new product called CardiSure, which is for congestive heart failure in dog. And CardiSure has grown by 86%, so again, very successful launch. In terms of the food-producing animal market, there's a couple of elements affecting the growth. Overall, you see a decline of 3%. However, we've talked in the past about the antibiotic and the pressure to reduce the use of antibiotics in large animals due to a concern of a resistance and cross-transfer to humans. What we do see is our water-soluble franchise actually did see modest growth despite the pressure. Other parts of our portfolio on food producing animals, have actually declined due to competitive pressure. Now, moving to diets, we see at constant rates, diet has grown by 3%, driven by the relaunch of our wet diet ranges and also by the launch of new therapeutic diets. Looking at revenue on a regional basis, Europe has grown by 66%. Now, if I include Eurovet in 2012 numbers to have a comparison on a like-for-like basis, the growth in Europe was 5%. Again, putting this in the context of what Ian presented earlier with Europe being declining, this is a very strong performance. Most of the territories performed very well, in particular UK, France and Germany, which shows that we have been very successful at integrating Eurovet quickly and with minimal disruptions to the market. The US, we've previously reported the supply issues. If I adjust for those, the core growth in the US has been 10%, well ahead of the animal health market growth in the US, which is more around 2%. So we do believe we have the foundation and we have delivered a very strong sales performance. If I move to slide 10, looking at our profit on a segmental basis and really looking at the pharmaceutical business. So this is the number on which we're going to build going forward. That's the foundation for our future business. We report overall operating profit of £39.1 million. I don't intend to cover all the numbers on this page, but I will point out here the R&D investment, moving from £5.7 million to £8 million, which is not only the result of the enlarged activities of the group following the Eurovet acquisition, but also the additional investments we're making behind our pipeline. I told you earlier that I would come back to gross margins, and I just wanted to explain the movement in gross margins, which is very much aligned and as expected based on following the Eurovet acquisition, where we had stated that the products coming from the Eurovet pipeline, the portfolio, sorry, had slightly lower margin, in particular in the fat segment and cap. So that product mix has changed our margin, and our margin now evolved from 57.2% down to 53.2%, all of which driven by a different product mix as we had reported before or anticipated. From a cost perspective, our expenses have simply grown in line with the enlarged group. And more importantly, I'm pleased to report that we have delivered the expected synergies from the Eurovet acquisition, which you can see here on this slide at £2.5 million. From a cash flow perspective, our position has very much improved, and our cash flow before dividend payments and repayment of borrowing has increased from £32 million to £60 million. The one other item to note in terms of last year is the one-off payment for a milestone to Dermapet, or a milestone of £10 million to Dermapet following the acquisition of this product in October 2010. So that was a commitment we had, which we met. Overall, this improved cash flow has also led to an improved position, a reduction of our net borrowing position, as we had expected and reported in a trading update. Our net borrowing position at the end of the year was £80.8 million. Now, of course, since the year end has closed, we've completed the divestment of services and we received the proceeds, but at the end of August, actually, we are in a net cash position of approximately £7 million. Now, our partners, the banks, are also around the table here, so I'm pleased to report now we fall well within the covenant linked to our debt. Now, just to cover, finish off with a few more numbers. I've talked about the EPS before, but we are proposing, so I'll move to dividends. We are proposing a dividend of 14 pence per share, very much aligned, proportional to our growth and aligned with our dividend policy. The other thing worth noting for the financial year end 2013 is the reduction in our tax rate, effective tax rate, going from 26.5% down to 24.1% as a result of reduction in tax rate in some of our overseas market and also in the UK. So if I turn to the future for a little while and talk about some of the items to consider moving forward, some of which we've already reported during the services divestment announcement. Aligned with our strategy, we will continue to invest behind the pipeline. It's also important to note there will be two factors influencing the EPS going forward. One will be the tax rate, and as most of our profits will be delivered in overseas geography, we expect the tax rate to go up. However, some of that will also be mitigated because we do expect a benefit from reduced interest as we will repay our debt, as announced previously. We've talked many times about the supply issues in the US, so I will not cover those in detail, other than to say the relaunch of those brands is also dependent on timings with FDA approval, and we do expect Ophthalmix to come back later in the financial year 2014 and Animax early in the financial year 2015. I've talked previously about our cash flow and an improvement of our cash flow. As a standalone pharma, we expect a modest improvement and cash conversion over 100%. So just to wrap up, before I hand back to Ian to talk about the pipeline, We have seen a very successful delivery in 2013, supporting by strong core performance in our markets and our products delivering growth. And we will continue to grow the business through the investment in R&D, and we see some of that in 2013. So let me hand back to Ian as you say.
Thanks, Anne. The pipeline has constantly delivered products, admittedly no blockbusters in the last couple of years, but in the 12 months we're reporting, there have been 9 significant registrations, a mixture of new territories for existing products, line extensions from existing products, but also 3 new products have been registered in the period. Probably the key points to make on this page are that Vetrol is now registered across the globe. The latest registrations are in South Korea and Brazil. Flimazole 1.25 milligram is quite important to us as well. This is part of a defence strategy against generics that are entering this market at the moment, and the generics clearly won't have this dosage form. Flimazole is an endocrine product, so that every cat has a different dosage. So by having a lower dose combination, we're able to give greater dosing flexibility, which gives greater control and balance to treating the cat. So, and it will be at least a year and a half, I would have thought, before we'll see the generic competition actually introducing that into their ranges. Comforton, Bupenadale and Anaskeetin, analgesic products, and we now have without question the widest range of analgesics of any animal health company within Europe. So that's a really key area of focus for us. We've promised that the half year will give a little bit more clarity on our product pipeline, particularly, you know, we've now got a clear veterinary pharmaceutical focus. And the 11 products we've outlined here are the key projects that we have ongoing at this current point in time. I don't intend to break down individual market sizes by product. There's a number of reasons for that. Firstly, a number of the therapeutic areas that we're moving into are new therapeutic areas where we're creating a drug which is treating a disease that can't currently be treated successfully. So it's very difficult to give a precise number for it. And the main reason is commercial sensitivity. You know, with a certain of these sectors, particularly endocrinology, if I was to tell you the market size, it would be evident to our competitors exactly which market within endocrinology we were looking at. So, you know, we don't want to go down that line. So you've got a clear picture of the key 11 projects we've got, and to just give a little bit more materiality to where we're up to with the 2 nearest term products, Osfos is number 4 on the list, which is the equine lameness product. This drug is imminently, within the next 2 or 3 weeks, being submitted to the UK, Canada and Australia for registration. As I've previously told everybody, we already have complete safety and efficacy letters from the FDA for the American registration. The reason we haven't already got the registration in America is because we had to change third-party manufacturers. The new manufacturer that has now produced the validation batches, which have proved successful and stable, is being inspected by the FDA at the end of September. So that filing is also imminent. The reason why we can submit in the UK and not the rest of Europe is that we don't treat the horse as a food-producing animal in the UK. We have something called a horse passport, which is European-wide, but the UK authorities will allow us to put an application in with what's called without a maximum residue limit. A maximum residue limit is what is the safe level of the drug in the meat in case you eat it. I mean, the thought of somebody actually eating a horse's knee is impractical, but nonetheless the regulators have to tick this box, so we have to go through this maximum residue limit analysis to get the product through through a central registration process within Europe. The canine endocrine disorder is a product that originally we decided to outsource to a German manufacturer that was unfortunately bought by Sandoz, who would no longer make it for us. At that point, because we'd got a successful FDA approval on capsules, it gave us confidence to take the sterile suite within our UK facility also through FDA approval, so we decided to bring this product in-house. But the clinical trial is ongoing and the results are very, very strong, so you know that's another near-term product. So we've now, at the moment, got 3 clinical trials which are ongoing. So, you know, that's and if you include the MRL study, which is also the maximum residue limit study, that's another 4th clinical study we've got going on. For a company of our size, that's a huge amount of activity. Looking at future value, There's a conservative 35 million that we're estimating once these products reach maturity. But I think what's also important is I don't want to give the impression that we only have 11 products in development. There's a whole range of other activities that goes on by the regulatory team outside of these 11 products. We're exploring new opportunities which will hopefully add to products for 2017, 2018 and 2019. We're also looking at other line extensions, and we're constantly looking to expand our key products into new geographical territories and new registrations. Additionally, we're also developing the specific range of pet products, pet diets, to keep the range fresh, to keep us into new clinical areas. So we have a burgeoning pipeline. Page 22 is a very busy slide, but to try and explain it, first of all, the green arrows on the first four therapeutic categories demonstrate that that's a global market that's seeing growth at the moment. And as you can see, our growth, which is the percentage figures underneath that, is particularly strong. We're looking at endocrinology, 18%, and ophthalmology, 28%, you know, very strong position. Cardiovascular is extremely strong because we're starting from a low base. But still, as Anne mentioned earlier, Cardishore has been a very successful product for us. In terms of the equine market, it's currently flat, but we still see this as a key therapeutic sector. Once global economies start to improve, people will start to breed more horses and this market will start to increase again. And apart from that, we've got some very good ideas in terms of novel therapeutic treatments that we can introduce into this sector. And if you can look, we've highlighted the 11 projects in the pipeline, and as you can see, every one of our key 11 projects falls into one of our key focus therapeutic sectors. Just briefly, a few more words on operational changes within the organisation. Clearly there's been a restructuring following the sale of the services segment. Manufacturing also has been under a lot of scrutiny following the Eurovet acquisition, and we identified actually prior to the Eurovet acquisition with the new facility we have in Blaville in Holland that we would no longer need the Oldham facility in Denmark, and that will be closed before the end of this calendar year. We haven't turned our back on Denmark. It's still a very important location for us. It is the centre for our distribution, and we're currently doubling the size of the warehouse capacity there with a new build on a freehold site. And what that allows us to do is to centralise all our European distribution, which is fragmented at the current time. We're still working on the introduction of Oracle across the group. The second phase will be the go-live, which will be in this calendar year within Blaadl Manufacturing, and next year we'll be rolling out Oracle as our ERP solution to the rest of the group from a sales and marketing perspective, with the exclusion of probably America and Germany, which will come as a third phase. We continue to invest in the US infrastructure. We're still underweight in terms of the number of people that we need from a sales and marketing perspective, and that investment will be commensurate with growth going forward. Finally, other than strengthening the management with people, not least Anne and a couple of new non-exec directors, but we've also moved Decra's head office into new modern office facilities, and for the people in those office facilities, you've even got windows now. The listing online, hence the comment. So, to finalise, just looking at the prospects and to add on to the detail that Anne provided earlier, you know, we are making very good progress with the pipeline. There's a lot of value for organic growth within that pipeline. We are in the process of redefining and re-examining our pure, clear pharma focus. If you look at midterm objectives, we've identified a number of geographies which we will be entering with a Decra brand. So instead of having marketing partners, we've recognised three territories where we'll be starting up under the Decra brand within the next 2 years. We obviously are doing a very good job of extending our existing portfolio and getting a maximum return from that portfolio. We've got a strong balance sheet, so we can now look at a number of other opportunities to invest in. And to finalise, current trading has been very strong, having had a very difficult third quarter to the last financial year. I'm pleased to say that the new financial year has started very, very well indeed. And on that note, I'm happy to take questions.
Hi, Ian. Just looking at the results of this, obviously we look at farm animal business, and it was a little bit soft. Would you say that you're subscale in farm animals, and is that an area in Europe where you might look to do something for acquisitions? And if so, what are you looking for? To sort of expand the farm animal footprint? Is it sort of diagnostics, or is it more product, or is it more geography in that space?
Well, you sort of answered your first question by saying that we need to be looking at something within the sector we're underway, which is the farm animal sector and the food animal market. We do accept that. We are underway. I don't accept that our performance has been soft, because if you look at the overall market, the antibiotic usage is coming under a lot of self-regulated pressure by vets, and we have performed better than the market has on our key focus areas of water-soluble antibiotics. In terms of what we're looking at, probably the slightly dangerous position for me to start outlining exactly what we're looking at. We do understand that we'd like to increase our presence within the food animal sector, particularly as you start moving outside of Western Europe and North America. This is one of the reasons we wanted to get into the food animal market in the first place, because we recognise it's a growth area within emerging markets. But I'm not at this point in time prepared to say specifically what it is we're looking at.
Can you rule out something? I mean, you're not going to move into sort of, food producing
llamas. Yeah, there's a number of opportunities that we're looking at the moment. I don't think anything's advanced enough for me one to really to start showing our hand on the answer to that question. Sorry, Sarah.
Got a few questions.
Sure.
Just trying to understand European situation in a bit more detail. So, Flimazole generic, when was that introduced, and how does that actually impact behaviours? Because it's not the same as the sort of human drug segment. We don't need substitutions, so it's just a pure brand competition.
Yeah, the brand, there was already a competitor for Flimazole with something called Vidalta, which is actually a slightly different drug. It metabolizes to the same drug, but in reality there's a slightly different marketing angle from Vidalta. So we've always had competition. We've now seen pure generic competition, and we're seeing that in two or three of the major markets. There's still a lot of growth to go within this sector. The market is still seeing growth. So that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to see a big downturn in Flimazole, particularly with the launch of the new strength. But to answer your question relative to human medicine, without question the profile is very different from something going generic in the human market, where within 12 months you can see 90% devaluation. No, the competitors will be coming in as a brand. They'll typically sell 15 or 20% cheaper. But there are a lot of benefits that we can bring to Flimazole, not least it's a sugar-coated tablet. It's very tiny, it's easier to dose. The generics have come in with a film-coated tablet, which isn't going to be quite as suitable for giving to a cat. And as I said, we've got the range. So no, I don't expect to see a big devaluation of the market.
Because it's been doing 10% plus, and that's with this kind of competition.
Correct.
So I can assume that that's the kind of...
Well, I think you've got to bear in mind that there's a lot of countries where it's growth, because there's a market growth, because the understanding of feline hyperthyroidism is increasing. And the cat in different societies has different values, but the cat is becoming more akin to a dog in terms of the way that pet ownership, the value that put on cats. You've all probably been on your holidays to Greece where the cat has little value, but I'm fortunately pleased to say that isn't the case in many societies in Western Europe, and certainly not in America.
Okay, and then just turning to food animal stuff, the antibiotics effect. I mean, you mentioned that there was competitive pressure, but that I would imagine that would hit volumes. Can you just sort of give us a sense of what's been happening in terms of price and volume in that segment of your business?
So I think in that segment, There's two issues. The first one we were talking about earlier for the water soluble, which is about the reduction in antibiotic prescribing. And here we have maintained our sales and have actually seen modest sales growth. The other part of our portfolio has seen competitive pressure, and that's actually more loss of market share, in particular with a product called CycloSpray, where there's competition from MSD, if I recall, an MSD product.
Angamycin.
Yes. Yeah. And CycloSpray is for foot rot, which we are now addressing as we go into the new financial year. So we've put in place a revised strategy to address that.
And this sort of slowdown in use of antibiotics, is that sort of ongoing, or do you think that's now impacting the market and it's normalised?
It's a country-by-country basis. We have a huge exposure in Holland because Eurovet was a Dutch company, so they got a big market share in Holland. And Holland is the country that has focused most on antibiotic reduction. What we have seen is now that EMEA, European Medicines Agency, have actually looked at collecting data on antibiotic usage on a country-by-country basis, trying to refer it back to kilogram of livestock. And it was evident Holland were a big abuser of overuse of antibiotics. There's probably good reason to it, because they've got very intensive pig and poultry units in Holland. But it has been self-regulation, but we have had exposure to that market, and Eurovet, prior to we bought them, had taken most of the hit. So we had recognised that. At the moment, Germany is the country that is putting a lot of new scrutiny. But unfortunately, Germany wasn't included in the evaluation report. It's difficult to actually say where they are relative to other countries. But I think, a couple of points to make. There are a couple of unique aspects to our water-soluble products. They are more soluble than the competitors, and, that creates an advantage that you can use slightly less. And also, we have very low market shares, so we're looking to increase market shares. And I think the final factor is, if you look at things like methoxazole that we've just launched, one of the new products for poultry, that's more of a narrow spectrum antibiotic. So a lot of the downturn in usage is broad spectrum products that just kill everything, and therefore are going to be more susceptible to the potential creation of MRSA type bugs that are difficult to treat going forward. So it's about refocusing your effort as well. And a lot of the injectables, which is another area of focus for us, you're giving to a specific cow, whereas or pig, as opposed to historically, if you give something in a water soluble environment, you're giving it to the whole herd. So again, that's about targeting specific animals as opposed to blanket treatment.
Just two quick questions on the pipeline. Obviously can't go into detail by product, but for the collective, the 11 items you've got on there, could you give us an idea what kind of margins you think that group of products could?
Well, the vast majority of them are companion animals, so the biggest value is still in the companion animal products, so margins north of 65%.
And to say, you've got different territories for each, obviously, because the markets are either there or underdeveloped. Can you explain a little bit more detail on why you've chosen international markets, not EU?
Well,
they're products as well.
Predominantly the ones that say EU. The bottom three antimicrobial ones are generic applications, a differentiated generic, so you can only do a generic based on in an EU dossier. The other two that are EU orientated are really to do with the market dynamics. In America, you've seen what's happened within Vetrol, and we talked a lot in the past about compounding pharmacy. So there's certain products that it's pointless to develop if you can't get some sort of IP protection, or you can't guarantee you're going to get a veterinary use. It's pointless spending the money on developing for the US market.
Okay. And in terms of timelines for coming out as well, obviously there's a lot of stuff that's not on here that you talk about as well.
Sure, but if you look at the 9 products that we've approved within this year, they wouldn't have been on this 11.
Exactly. So can we look to this year, next year, as being 9 other products that could come
through? Well, I think 9 was extremely successful year. I think if you look most years, we get 3, 4, or 5 registrations.
And then these big ones?
These big ones will come along as well.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit more about the US? It's obviously fairly well documented. issues that you have. Yeah. As we start coming back, but yeah, it's still 10% or so of group revenues, and
yeah.
See the market overall is significantly bigger. Is this a priority for you to kind of accelerate the growth within the US market? And how do you envisage that playing out? Obviously, you'll get some of the stuff coming through from the pipeline at the time naturally. But is there areas of the portfolio you'd like to? Yes.
Well, I think the problem is if you start looking at trying to do that by acquisition in the US is tied up by big pharma, and there's very little in terms of quality businesses that are worth actually looking at. So, you know, we have to look at other ways of licensing in, or predominantly by our pipeline. And if you look at the pipeline, a huge amount of the value is in the US. So, you know, we believe organically we can get exceptional growth in 2 or 3 years' time with the pipeline. And don't forget, we will get the ophthalmics back. You know, that's a matter of when. And Animax as well, hopefully within 12 months. And they will make a big difference. You know, one of the benefits to Animax is that there was only one competitive product, which has also gone off the market permanently. So when that product comes back, you know, it was, I think at its peak, it was $4 or $5 million. You know, it should be a bigger product than that again once we've had it back in the market for 2 or 3 years, because there's nothing really as good a product.
What are patients using? Sorry, what patients? What is a veterinary?
Well, it's a combination product. They can use individual drug treatments.
Okay. So if you look at that $35 million kind of value, what percentage would be the US then?
Actually, it is an equal split, you know, between.
Yeah.
You were talking about the pipeline value.
Yeah, pipeline.
Yeah. So it is an equal split, and it's fairly well allocated geographically.
What one of the products particularly we're quite excited about for the US? And they are, you know, it's very difficult to come and put a number in front of you. Clearly, we're going to put a conservative number in front of you. So, you know, there is a potential that one of these products could exceed our expectations. But, you know, it's very, very difficult when you move into markets like the US where there's competition. Although we're going in with new molecules, you know, it's very difficult to change prescribing habits of vets very quickly. But, you know, there are clinical advantages to the majority of products. Well, all the products that we're taking into the US, there is a clinical advantage. But it's how long it will take us to reach maturity within that market is a very difficult thing to say. I mean, you've known us for a long time. You know, we said Vetrel should be a $20 million market. We're not at $20 million yet. I think Vetrel's running at, what, $11 million? It should be a $20 million product, but it's going to take us longer to get there. And, of course, we've got issues such as the prescribing cascade doesn't exist in America, and we have compounding pharmacies. So, you know, I think we're comfortable with the $35 million as being a conservative number. But clearly, we'd like to significantly exceed that number.
So, how many of the products in this portfolio would you think would get you as excited as Vetrel did when you were developing that?
3 or 4.
And just on the food animal segment, can you give us a sense on kind of what the split of revenues by species is roughly?
It's nearly all pig and poultry. Which is, you know, going back to the product that's going backwards, is foot loss aerosol for cattle. One of the reasons is that we're not really into cattle, you know, in a big way. So, and the major markets that product is actually marketed for us. We don't even market it ourselves. Other than Germany.
Just on R&D, I noticed that the capitalisation of R&D has also gone up. Is that just an absorption of Eurovet, or is that just a... Is that another effect that's happened there?
So there's Eurovet, and some of the spend of our products ready to launch is capitalized. So it's a mixture of the two. Half of the spend of that is on products ready to launch.
Okay, so and when you sort of give guidance about that investment increasing, is that beyond the increase in the top line, or is it just sort of a measured increase in investment in R&D?
So the increase I was referring to was looking at overall pipeline spend, so our overall R&D spend. Our policy in terms of capitalization is we expense cost and we only start capitalizing when we are likely or very close to getting regulatory approval.
If I look at total R&D, it's both expensed and capital, about 5.5% and you've guided to increased investment. Is it going to stay constant or below 5.5%, or is it going to start to go up?
We do not look at R&D as a percentage of sales, in fact, Stefan. What we do look at is what products do we have in the pipeline, and the commercial viability, the scientific viability, and the financial return, and we make investment decisions on that basis, you know, using as well sound financial criteria. That is what will drive our spend. The other thing to add on that is, you know, compared to big pharma, we don't spend a lot on discovery. We spend on development, so we have, I guess, in many ways, a higher likelihood of success. So percentage of sales is not the driver.
I agree, you get great returns. And I guess just broadening that question. So you've obviously moved into, but if I look at the attractiveness of the market and the margin of products, it seems to me like companion animals by far the more attractive area to invest in R&D.
But you're limited globally, and also could I refer you back to the chart that showed where the growth in animal health markets were, and it's in the livestock sector, not in the companion animal sector. So yes, we've found some really excellent specialist therapeutic areas where we're seeing really good growth, but to be honest, if you're going to become a global animal health company, you have to be in the livestock sector as well. And that's our ambition.
Yeah, what farm animal markets will enable us to do is enter different geographies where actually farm animal is larger, and you wouldn't justify a companion animal portfolio on its own. So it's really your entry ticket.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, then eventually, you know, the lot of the emerging markets also, the specialist companion animal products will grow, and you'll start to see growth. And as Anne said, you need an entry ticket in there in the first place.
It seems to me, if I was going to sort of give a guess at the direction of your M&A, it would be more the geographic side of things than anything else, like the US.
I think back to the point that you know, I was, it's quite funny really, I've always said that we've never been dependent on acquisition, although we have made a lot of acquisitions, but our focus has never been to be relying on that, because seven big pharmaceutical companies absolutely dominate animal health globally. You know, they control 80% plus of the world's veterinary pharmaceuticals. So there are very few opportunities to make acquisitions in an ideal nature. You know, we were very successful in being able to acquire the two major companies we'd identified 6 or 7 years ago, Vetex and Eurovet. You know, we did an excellent job to bring those in, but there are no obvious Eurovets or Vetexes as the next step forward. So wouldn't necessarily say that it's a definitive that the next acquisition will be outside of our existing territories, but it's certainly something we're looking at. Sarah.
I've got some sort of nitty-gritty financial questions, so I'll just fire them at you, Anne-Françoise, and I've got a more general question to get to. So CapEx, obviously we're looking at 3.7, is that a good starting point for the next couple of years, or is that sort of investment that you're talking about going to sort of lead to some increased CapEx? You've already obviously talked about what's happening in Denmark.
I'm going to take them one at a time.
Yeah, CapEx.
Thank you, Ian. I was taking notes, so I could see you already, Sarah. So in terms of CapEx, the only increase we anticipate is the warehouse, and then the investment in Oracle, some of which is already bedded down. So it's not a material number that will change.
So around the 3.5 to 4 million is a steady number to think about, okay? And depreciation charge gone from 1.6 to 2.8. You know, is that 2.8 now the new sort of cycle for us?
Yes, I'll double check that when we talk through the assumptions. But
and obviously the amortization, we've had the amortization because of your, it's gone from 10.5 to 18.4.
That stays. So none of that was related to services. So the acquired intangibles remain as that.
Remains. Okay, great. And then the sort of overarching question I was going to ask you, Anne-Françoise, is that obviously you've come from a human pharmaceutical space, and now you're in veterinary pharmaceutical. You've already talked about maybe lower risk in veterinary development, but you know, when you are capitalising R&D, how comfortable comfortable are you with doing that, and is that sort of good practice in the new environment that you find yourself in?
So our approach is very conservative, I would say, and most of the R&D spend is expense. We only start capitalizing, you know, as disclosed very much as well in the accounting principles in our annual accounts, once we are very clear that we will gain regulatory approval and our committee gets together, we discuss with the R&D team and assess, you know, the percentage of success. So
it's basically when we file the product, yes. So you know, no real risk to that at all, and it is very conservative.
And we aligned the methodology last year. Eurovet has slightly different accounting principles. We aligned all of that.
But conceptually, you're handicapping sort of, you know, your profits down the line for a short-term benefit, because you're going to have to, if you're capitalising, you're going to have to.
But we capitalise very little other than really the registration fees. Once it's, as Tuan said, was dead certainty, you know, and
if anything, we
expense the vast majority of the development spend is expense.
Plus we amortise as well very quickly.
Okay. So as accelerated amortisation as well. 3 years.
Well, we amortise over 10 years.
Over 10 And you know, a more sort of strategic question to Ian. As you said, we've known you for a long time, and obviously the business has now changed dramatically since even 3 or 4 months ago. Is there a change to strategy? What is the end game for Dekra? Are you looking to sort of build, you know, a business that is going to sort of be a standalone business, or you know, is the board going to look towards getting this business at a good sort of growth trajectory, which will eventually might become attractive to someone else to come and acquire?
We obviously felt that selling services may represent a little bit of a risk. You know, I know one or two people have judged MBS as a poison pill, but I believe we've delivered exceptional shareholder value over the last 10 years, and we intend to maintain a strong relationship with our shareholders, so hopefully that if anybody ever came after us, then it would have to be one hell of a premium for shareholders ever to want to see it as a best option for them to divest of the holding. Does that answer the question? So if, you know, Dekra is very much a young company, and I think we can still deliver a lot of growth out of it, and we're certainly, even with what we're going on today, we're certainly a few years off, I think, delivering anything like the value within the business that's intrinsically within what's going on.
Great, thank you.
You also have had a pretty good sell by distributors into the emerging markets. From what you're saying, are there things that you prefer to hold on to them
and go
yourself?
No, we do. We sell into 44 countries worldwide. A range of products, and we're constantly, you know, for instance, I just said that we've just licensed Vetrol within Brazil and into South Korea. They are actually marketed in those territories by partners, but we tend to give sort of 5-year marketing agreements. And you know, if you look, one of the territories that we're going to be entering is a European territory in the not too distant future. It's now because we've got all the registrations, we've got enough critical mass to go on our own. So the idea is with some of the emerging countries that we'll get our own registrations, but with a longer term view within some of the key geographies that eventually would like our own Dekra subsidiary. Because of course, if you give a product to a marketing partner, they take about half the margin off you. Mm.
But to begin with, it doesn't work on your own sales force, so you effectively get them to make the market for you with your product.
Yes.
So are you in, like, to China?
We're no, we're not in China at all, no. But China's a very difficult market, and you've got to bear in mind it's fairly early days in terms of looking around the globe. We're just ventured into Brazil, we've just ventured into South Korea, we're currently looking at options within China, but it's, you know, you've got to be very careful, we don't spread ourselves too thinly too quickly, and we're also not like Big Pharma that can go and throw money at something and lose money for 2 or 3 years. You know, any entrance into a market has to be profitable.
And is it on both sides, companion animal and?
It varies on a territory by territory basis. Okay, thank you very much. Sorry. Is there anybody on the conference facility who would like to ask a question?
One moment. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question via your telephone, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And we have a question coming through from the line of Keith Redpath of FinCap. Please go ahead.
Morning, chaps. Just coming back to some of your observations then, drilling it down to an answer. The growth in the market, although you're growing successfully in Western markets, but those are rather moated, the growth in the market is food animals and is Asia and rest of world. At the moment, you're doing that through distribution partners and exploiting your current portfolio, and then you mentioned that you have a nice strong balance sheet, which is also a good point. So if you were, and the absence of acquisitions, do I take it that when you talked acquisitions, you were talking companies, not necessarily buying product from other people?
I think people don't easily dispose of their animal health assets. It's focus for a lot of the companies that are still in animal health. So no, we tend to be looking at smaller companies rather than assets.
And would that include stepping into companies that have distribution in some of these geographies outside of Europe?
Yes, possibly.
Not just R&D companies like.
If you create an ideal scenario, that it would be a company in a new geography that has IP that we can extend into other countries, but ideal scenarios don't come along that often.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
Thank you.
We currently have no further questions coming through on the phone, so one final reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Okay, everybody, I think we'll wrap up at that. Thank you very much. Appreciate your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining today's conference. You may now disconnect your lines.